But you're going to have a really high impact on those companies that are, you know, $2 million and north of, $3 million, $4 million, $5 million. Because to get to that point, here's what they needed to have: a very high tolerance for pain and a willingness to lose the battles to win the war.
Welcome back to another episode of The Pursuit of Purpose. My name is Chris Kiefer, and today I am joined by Jason Paris, who is the founder of Paris Painting and a partner in Aleph Holdings, as well as not self-proclaimed. I think this was verified by multiple countries, an expert in synergy and memes. So Jason, tell us, first of all, thanks for coming on. This is fun. I'm looking forward to this.
My pleasure.
And tell us, who's Jason Paris besides the title?
Ooh, okay. Who am I? I am but a moment in a changing river. You know, just kind of always, never step in the same river twice. A lot of people know me, founder of Paris Painting, like you introduced, which essentially birthed out Aleph Holdings. I'm 36 years old, so kind of getting into that midlife crisis stage. I have 5 kids, beautiful wife, activities and hobbies. I like ultra running. I like playing video games quite a bit. I've gotten into aviation. It's been a recent hobby of mine. And I like volunteering with the PCA, which is Painting Contractors Association. I do quite a bit of kind of board level volunteer work with them.
Interesting. So I love entrepreneurs that have big families. So tell me about, did you come from a big family? What was the inspiration or desire? Because I'm sure this happens to you. We have 4 kids and we plan on having some more. I don't know how many, but I think families are great. I come from a family of 5. My dad was from a family of 5. My mom was from a family of 5. We have some friends that have like a lot more kids, but most people are like, oh, wow, you have 4. Like, yeah, we do. And it's fantastic. I love every minute of it.
Yeah. It's like 2 per adult. Yeah.
tell me about the, why is that important to you? Or why, what do you tell people when you tell them about your family?
Yeah, I'd say we have been very fortunate. Not everybody is able to have a big family or able to have kids. And it's kind of, we don't take that for granted. So it's certainly, that's been helpful for us, is whenever there is a desire, I feel like we've just been immediately blessed, granted the request, however you want to spin it. Our first kid was born in June. My wife said she didn't want to be pregnant in the summer ever again. And so then we were born April.
Love it.
So we're pretty like on the money when it comes to timing these things out. But I think you know, kind of the title of this is even funny or interesting. The pursuit of purpose, you know, sometimes giving is like what we're meant to do. We're meant to contribute. We're meant to add to something that's greater than ourselves. I think having kids is one of the most selfless things you can do. And you learn very quickly the joy that comes from have like a self-sacrificial hobby, activity, purpose that you're leaning into. And I would just say, you know, once we had 3 kids, there was a big decision around the 4th, which was, I'm not going to do this to be more comfortable. We're not going to have a 4th kid so I can have more free time. We're not having a 4th kid, so I'm going to be more, you know, yeah, me time. If you want more free time, if you want to serve yourself more, do not have a big family. But there's also, it's harder to find anything more fulfilling and more serving with and from a purpose standpoint than having a big family. So it's kind of like a paradoxical cycle of you're doing this knowing that I would never do that if I wanted more free time, more money, less stress, cleaner house, right? All these things that I think would give me fulfillment. But it is in that self-sacrificial pursuit that you're finding kind of the ultimate fulfillment. And these are all tastes of things. And my mental paradigm, they operate, is more of a Judeo-Christian paradigm. So I think of these as somewhat metaphors. But you get a little bit of a taste when you first get married. Right? It's like, oh, I'm here to serve somebody. And if you get married because you want more free time, you want a cleaner house, you want to serve yourself more, it's the wrong decision. Right? And then you start having kids and you kind of get any selfishness beaten out of you, right? You lose a lot of your selfishness when you get married. If there's anything left once you have kids, it's just beaten out of you. So that's kind of, we talk about a big family. You know, I think we're extremely blessed, and we love big families too.
I think I love that you just, I resonate with a lot of the things you're saying, that my wife is a, she doesn't take on clients or patients, I guess. She's a women's health pelvic floor physical therapist. So she specifically is working with pre and postpartum women all the time. And she also is a practitioner of a fertility awareness-based method called Creighton. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's a like NFP, but like more modern and more reliable than some other models. But anyways, the reason I bring that up is that she's constantly working with people that are struggling to have kids. And I do think that it's cool that you brought up. Yes, it's like not everyone can, like her sister and brother, our brother-in-law, they're not able to have kids, you know? And so they're looking at adoption or whatever, but yeah, it is easy. It's like the number of things in life that we take for granted until you can't have that, or you it's taken away or whatever. And I think that's a great place to come from. The one thing I wanted to also say is that, well, this is just like, so we have younger kids and our 4-year-old just this couple days ago was Valentine's Day. And, you know, he's kind of a punk. He, you know, sometimes he's not a great listener and we're still working on all that stuff, but he came into my room and this is like, tell me anything else in the world that compares to this, what I'm about to tell you. He comes into my room and he had made a Valentine's card for me and he made a heart for the first time ever. Apparently that's what he said. And it was like a rectangular shaped like thing that kind of, I mean, it definitely resembled a heart, but if he hadn't told me, I wouldn't have known, you know? So he was like, "Hey dad, I made you a Valentine's card. Just so like, you know, in case I'm ever not here, or I go to Nana's house, you just remember that I love you." And I was like, "Thanks buddy. Like, I appreciate that." And he's like, "I think I'm just going to go put this by your nightstand so that you always see it." And I was like, "That's awesome." And it's like, that's, you know, then you go back to like how many times I'm up in the middle of the night cleaning up puke and poopy diapers and all the stuff, you know, it's like, it's a fate. There's a season of the really, really hard work, when they're little. And then it gets, in my experience, and your kids are a little bit older, but it just keeps getting better, you know? And then I can't wait for the day that they're teaching me stuff and being like, "Oh dad, you're such a grandpa. Like you don't know anything, you know?" It's like, yes, bring it on. Yeah. Bring it on. So anyways, that's fantastic. Any other thoughts to wrap up that topic?
No, I'm right with you there, man. I love buying expensive Apple products, and I would say kids are like way better than iPads or iPhones or even the Vision Pro that I saw you playing around with.
Oh, did you just get it?
No, I saw you playing. I saw the video of you playing around with it. I thought that was pretty catchy.
I have an Apple addiction as well, but it would be,
yeah, yes, yeah.
The good thing is that because I'm in tech and everything's a business write off.
I was gonna say it's a lot easier when you're on a business because then you can kind of squint and say,
yeah, it's research. It's research. I got market research. Yeah. And I can tell you that, in a couple of years, I think there's going to be some pretty insane apps and stuff that are better.
Well, you remember when the Apple Watch first came out, it was super laggy and super weird. And now that the Apple Watch is super crisp, and it's like, I do love how they just branded it Tomorrow's Technology Today. Cause it is just like, I can kind of squint and see how this is useful. But you know, with a few iterations, it's going to be all that friction starts to go away.
Oh yeah. Or like once estimating software actually makes a dedicated app for the Apple Vision, and you can like right now they have apps already that you can like in my office, if I put it on, I could immediately, it detects all the surfaces and tells you the square footage of every single surface that's in the area that you're looking at. And you just go like, "I want to paint that wall, that wall, that wall, that wall." And it's just like import into your estimating tool or whatever. And just like, potentially I would think you wouldn't even need to, this is eventually, who knows how far away this is, but you literally like walk around a house And then it's going to, you still would want someone to verify everything, but it'd count your windows and get the square footage of the siding and the heights and all that stuff. But yeah, I'm the nerdy guy that's like,
it's super exciting. And then I start to think through, what is that solving? And it's solving maybe human error, and it's solving like maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes of time. So it solves it, but it's also not like, let's not get.
Yeah. Like how long does it actually take to estimate a house?
Lost in like how, what is the actual change? And like 20 minutes is meaningful, right? You can probably squeeze out a few more estimates, you know, per estimator per week.
I love how tech, like that's fantastic that you immediately go to like, okay, let's play this out. Best case scenario.
Yeah. But what it's not like tripling my sales. It's not like the ability to sell a paint job is fundamentally transformed because the act of measuring becomes lower friction. Right?
Yeah.
So just starting to think through now, that's not to say there isn't juice in that squeeze, but it's not like I squeeze and it's like a fountain of juice just poured out and now I don't have to run a business anymore.
Yeah. I love that you said run a business because my company works specifically with automating painting businesses. That's what we do. Eliminate as much data entry as possible, get rid of paper, all that stuff. But people will comment, like frequently come to me and I like, depending on the size, like if you're running a $4 to $7 million painting company, certainly you have gotten some management stuff figured out. You're a decent leader. You've gotten some right people in place. Maybe you get to that size and you've like tricked a bunch of people to work for you or who knows what. But when you're, I guess at any size, it's true for any, but smaller companies that are struggling to break past $1 million or $2 million in revenue, it's not a technology problem. It's not like it's management, it's systems, processes, like setting a vision for your company and telling people how they fit into that and getting people excited. Like, giving you the right software isn't going to help you break through the ceiling of the next revenue mark.
It's kind of like someone training for a marathon, like spending all their time trying to figure out how cold should the cold tub be?
Yeah.
Well, that might get you like 0.1% better.
Yeah. There's a lot of work you got to put in.
You should probably start with like running, weightlifting, sleeping, and eating. That would be where I'd spend most of your time.
And that's what's the hardest that prevents most people from doing it.
Yeah. Just like automation, the more you reduce the friction of the actual work of running a business, right, the less bandwidth has to get lost into these slippery, you know, leaky items. Right. So someone's like, yeah, I'd love to run my business. I'm spending all of my time transferring paper to paper to paper. And I'm just like, there's like a leaky faucet of my bandwidth. If I had that bandwidth, I could focus more on the business, right? And that's where you'd kind of maybe say like, yeah, I'd love to exercise more. I'm just so sore and I have a low tolerance for pain that I can't build up. So I want to get my cold tub perfect, right? That's like obviously a broken metaphor.
Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing of like, at the end of the day, you have to think percentage, I think in percentages, like let's say tech makes you 10% more efficient or something, right? Pick a number, it doesn't matter. Even if it's 2%, a 2% of a $1 million company is a far different number than 2% of a $7, $8, $10, $15 million company, right? The little tiny cracks that you're like, ah, and you should be like, ah, when you're $1 million, cause you got bigger fish to fry at a big company. It's like, there's a lot of money just flooding out of your, or flooding into your boat. I don't even know what analogy I'm using anymore. That's just that. There's a lot of money that's just rolling away because you don't have tight systems and processes. But that again goes back to every single time you can implement and build the coolest tech and the best systems, and businesses will fail implementing it because they lack compliance and they've never been able to follow any process, you know, and everything requires a process.
Yeah. The way that I would position your company is, you probably have a really high impact. You have many different positions you can take, but you're gonna have a really high impact on those companies that are, you know, $2 million and north of, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million. Because to get to that point, here's what they needed to have: a very high tolerance for pain and a willingness to win, to lose the battles to win the war. So it's like, yeah, I could tighten everything up, but I wouldn't be a fast growing entrepreneurial off the ground company. Now that I've gotten to $3 million, I need to begin the journey of professionalizing and tightening things up. And that's actually the opposite of what has gotten me here. If someone's like a micromanager worried about making sure the ship has no leaks, that's usually not a founder. That's like a mid-level manager. And mid-level managers don't get companies from zero to one or zero to something, right? And so you kind of come like, hey, this is no shame. This is actually pretty normal. If you didn't have leaks, you wouldn't be here. But now, guess what? We don't need to continue to scale, and you can't grow with like the weak. If we continue to scale, these leaks are going to put you under. So now is the time to tighten this up. Not to say there's no shame. Like you can't, they had to be there in a sense. You're wrong. Unless you're like, and that's just how painting companies run. I'm just thinking like, how would you,
I mean, that's how any business runs. It's like,
or like I was thinking, what is the opposite of that? I mean, unless you take on a ton of debt, you hire a bunch of mid-level managers, you tell them grow this thing slowly and perfectly, and I don't need a return for the next 5 years. That's how you would do it.
Yeah, I don't even know if that works, but I know what you're saying, you know, because
in theory, like that's how you would say, like, build me a big ship that doesn't leak.
Yeah. I like to think of I just was talking to someone else about this. It's kind of like when you got married, I don't know about you guys, but my wife and I, we lived in an apartment, and it was a 2-bedroom apartment. It was fantastic. It was close to where she went to grad school. We were close to downtown. We wanted to go out to restaurants and stuff, go on dates. And then we moved to a 3-bedroom house that was, you know, in a little development, and we had some kids, and then we moved to a different place. And now we have like a acre lot, big yard. We had chickens. We wouldn't have wanted or needed that. And it would have been a distraction when we were newlyweds and just getting our life started. And I feel like, to me, it's that, like the idea, it's not like, it's crazy. You don't even, not only is it crazy, you don't even know what your dream house is when you get married or you're starting out your life, right? Same thing in the business. It's like, why don't you see if you can like do this for a while? And if you love it, you know, if you don't love what you're doing, then find a different job, you know, or make a different job for yourself. But yeah, I completely agree that it all, for me, it's coming back to the, like, know where you're at and what like phase of life you're in or what phase of life your business is in and where you should be focusing your priorities. And cause it's like the analogies we were talking at the beginning with having kids and stuff. Like there are different, very distinct phases in everyone's life, and a business is no different.
Yeah. You never step in the same river twice. The stream is always flowing. People change, businesses change.
I thought when you said that earlier, I thought you were saying like, it's like a Chinese proverb to like, it's bad luck or something, but I see what you're saying. It's a completely different river every time.
Right. So when you ask like, who is Jason Paris? It's like, well, you never step in the same river twice.
You're different today than you were yesterday.
Yep. Different. Yep. I'm an evolving, changing.
Love that. So the other thing that I want to talk about is, which we have been doing, is the family meeting agenda.
That's awesome, man.
What's the, first of all, like, I can't even remember when we got married and when I started getting into like business strategy and stuff, I was like, man, we need to have a mission for our family. And we've gotten clear on our personal mission, my wife and I. Like each of us have our own. And then our business mission is to free you up to do what you love. That's what Boolean exists for. But we haven't done one for the family. And now we're getting closer to doing this. And it was through seeing your posts on social media of like, hey, number, I don't know what number you guys are on, 100 or 200 and something, right? How many family meetings have you done?
Hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah. And I was like, Natalie, check this out. And then you texted me the agenda and stuff. And I was like, this is fantastic. And so the first meeting that we had, we're like explaining to our kids. And again, they're all under 6. So it's like we had to adapt quite a bit, but it was cool because we got to the part of like the homestead, like, hey, what needs to be improved? What are we doing? Whatnot? And one of our kids was like, you know, this swing in our basement, when it is moving, it goes. And I was like, we can teach you about WD-40. So anyways, it's like,
it's like 50% of life. The other half is duct tape.
Yeah. Like that's right. So anyways, I was like, it was just intentionality around everything. We used to think, and I want to say my wife used to think more than I did that like structure was annoying. Like, I don't want to have a budget. Why do we have to plan our date nights? Let's just be spontaneous. And it's like, when you put in the big rocks in your life and you say, this is when we're doing this and this and this, and then you let whatever else wants to, it's a classic big rock, medium rock, sand, right? Do that first, and you're going to enjoy and have much more freedom to do what you actually want to do. And it's another counterintuitive thing where people think that I just want to be free. And it's like, what does that even mean? You know, like I feel very free and I have a very strict routine. I block out when I'm sleeping on my calendar and my workouts and everything, you know, which is maybe more than you need for some people. But I also feel like it opens you up to do more stuff and get like extract more out of the day than if you're just kind of like wondering what's going to happen next.
I think it starts with that vision statement too, as you're talking through, right? Without a compelling vision, that people will cast off their restraint.
Totally. Yeah.
Right? So why would you maintain discipline unless you knew where you were going? And that's like an underrated part of it. But I love what you're doing with the family meetings. That is a super cool thing. And it's kind of, people fall into the trap, I think, of, well, we're living together. I see you every day. And so the ethos of it is intentional time set aside once a week to just talk about things that may not come up day to day. And like, so you get a purpose statement, right? I like the idea of open, frequent communication, help all members of the family realize their potential. You're showing the kids how to perform in a meeting. You're showing them what it's like for mom and dad to talk about finances every single week.
Yes. I love that too. Yeah.
Right? Talk about like encouraging one another, you know, what was challenging. Let's remember the past week. Let's not let life just pass us by. Let's take a moment to reflect. Right. And then you get to bribe them with treats at the end. And so then when you're tired on a Friday and the last thing you want to do is have another meeting in the day, your kids are the ones that are driving and saying it's family meeting night. And it's just a fun expectation that who knows where it'll go. I did not come up with the idea of a family meeting, but I like the hold that's taken in this little niche community of house painters where it's gotten visibility, and I like that's encouraged people. I think that's super cool.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. I want to pivot into your, so Aleph Holdings, what is that? And what was the like origin story of why that was created? And now a quick word from our sponsor, which is Boolean Review. Boolean is a review software that my wife and I own, and we sell this software to home service businesses. So I know there are many different people that listen to this podcast, but if you know someone, an electrician, an HVAC business, a painting company, maybe a coffee stand, someone that is providing service to customers and get found online by customers, we would love to talk to them. This is a review software that is the highest converting review software in the home service space in particular. And if you're wondering what that means, if you have 100 clients in your business, the typical business gets between 1 to 2% of those customers. So for every 100, they would get one person or two people to leave them a review on Google. Other review softwares get between 3 and 5%, and the Boolean review software gets 20% of your customers to leave you Google reviews. And these are fantastic Google reviews with lots of words, keywords that are going to help with SEO, pictures, stories, the names of your employees. So if you want to learn more, check out BooleanReview.com. And now back to the episode.
So what it is, it's a holdings company. We make minority investments in house painting companies, and then come in as a fractional partner to help them scale and stabilize their business. So we're not like there's like multiple tiers. So there's consulting, there's coaching, there's partnering. We take active roles in the business to help scale and stabilize. That's kind of the differentiator or the rub that we position ourselves at. The origin, man, this started back in 2018, 2019, more as a concept of what is the next stage after Paris painting gets stabilized and mature. How would we do this in other trades-based businesses? And over the years, that's gotten more and more refined to house painting companies, with an emphasis of the why of being, how do we build assets together, right? It's like, how do you, beyond just enriching ourselves, how do we help teach others how to build assets, right? So it's like, how do you teach others how to fish? The like purpose statement, the why statement is conquering the fear of mammon, right? Mammon is that old funny word. It's oftentimes used used as finances, right? The fear of money. I view mammon as the systems and structures that man creates and architects to enslave itself. The most common one being money. This could also be fear, greed, lust, pride, envy. They're things that you are enslaving yourself with, only you can enslave yourself with. But if you live in America, if you live in capitalism, how do you conquer mammon? Foundationally, and I come kind of from, this is going to be my spiritual paradigm. You got to have the shalom, the peace of God, right? Without that, that's the foundation. Then you need to understand your imago Dei. What is your true identity spiritually from a creator? And then it also doesn't hurt if your assets outweigh your liabilities in life, right? And so you can't conquer the fear of mammon by earning a lot of money, right? You need to be understand the peace of God, understand your true identity, and then, you know, having the assets outweigh your liabilities in life, that helps you kind of shake off some of those shackles. The opposite of that would be, hey, I'm in tune with God. I'm in tune with who I am. I did take out $400K in student loans, and this sucks. I feel mammoned right now, right? That would be the opposite of that equation. So it kind of takes all of it going in the right direction, but that's a big part of the why, you know, going through some of those thought experiments of, you know, a lot of this is driven by my team. You know, not everybody wants to just grow Paris painting for the rest of their life and enrich the owners of Paris painting. But you start doing the thought experiment of let's fast forward 10, 20 years. Great. We've got tens of million dollars in our bank account. What do we want to do with our lives? It's like, well, I'd like to help others conquer the fear of mammon. How would you do that? Well, ultimately, I'd like to teach them how to be asset minded. So it would have a ripple effect beyond just their, just them, but possibly through their lineage, like through the generations that they would have. Well, how would you do that? You'd want to build an asset with them and walk through that and teach them how to fish. And so that's kind of a long-winded answer of what is it? What is the why? Where did it come from? Aleph is an old Hebrew word, means strength of the ox. Well, it's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, right? The pictogram is an ox. And so we view ourselves as oxen. They're coming shoulder to shoulder and yoking up to plow the fields, right? And build the harvest.
Love that. That's so cool.
There's many deep layers to that, right? Oftentimes when you yoke up two oxen, you have one that's more matured and one that's a little more bucking and wild. And those are the two best ones to yoke up. And then once they do yoke up, it's not a 1+1=2, but it's a 1+1=3. And two oxen yoked together don't do double what they typically do alone. They do three times what they can do alone. And then you're plowing the field behind you, which then provides the soil for a plentiful harvest.
Mm, I love that. So many cool analogies. So the, and you guys are specifically buying fractional minority stakes in painting companies.
Yeah. So come in typically a 40% purchase in a business. And then we come in and as a co-owner, we start to divvy up the roles of who wants to do what. And I'll just tell you, Will, we kind of talk through this. The founder is usually a visionary and a good startup integrator. Maybe I'll speak for myself in my journey in Paris painting, right? I was a good visionary and a good startup integrator. As Paris painting started to professionalize and mature, I was not going to be the best person to be the president of this organization. The last thing that I should be doing in my life is being the president of a $10 million painting company. That is, those type of people are like super dialed in. Like they want to make everything perfect and clean and crisp. They're like good at conflict. You have specialists in their role as opposed to more of a generalist that has a high tolerance for pain and can get things done, right? And so that, yeah, I'll just say that's kind of the general ethos as we come in knowing that we're working with founders. We're kind of good at everything, but they need a team of specialists to come in and yoke up in their business to truly scale it and stabilize. And it is, I would just say, it's also for business owners that want to turn their business into an asset. And while that sounds like obvious, like who wouldn't want to do that? I would say most people in the trades actually don't when you get down to it. They want a lifestyle business that they own 100% and they control. To take on a partner is a pretty big ego shift, kind of ego death that comes with that, right? But on the pathway to scaling and stabilizing something, that is, you know, almost all the time, that's how businesses get built, right? It's not by a single charismatic owner. They're usually taking on co-owners, co-founders, executives with stock options, right? This is how you scale and stabilize a business. beyond being an extension of yourself, if that's what you desire.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that, I'm curious, the, I assume that the company size is like, I'm trying to think, like there's the entrepreneurs organization. Have you heard of the EO? So like an EO, you can't be an EO unless you're past $1 million in revenue, just because it's like, I feel like at first, like, again, this is like high school Chris or college minded Chris was like, what? That's a dumb rule. Like I work hard. Like, let me show you. It's like, no, that's great. But there is certain things that the revenue says about the stage of life, who they might have in the business. And it's like, just like an easy bar. It doesn't mean that you're going to be a healthy run business, but there is generally revenue implies some stuff and you still got to do some, you know, due diligence and research. But I'm assuming that you guys know that you're like, what's your ideal painting company that you're trying to buy a stake in?
Yeah. Like at least 1.5 million. And I would say we've definitely squinted and gone down to one if it's with the right founder and they have some of that momentum as a team. But kind of the truth of the matter is that you need so much infrastructure. You need to be able to handle and absorb the infrastructure that we're about to plug in. And you have to be able to at least have something that can begin to absorb that. I mean, the journey of professionalizing, if you're going to talk about house painting companies, this is broad generalizations based off of an average job size and the geography you're trying to work in, which will drive the complexity of the org chart that's required. It's probably about $3 million, right? At that point, you're trying to now scale through skill, right? As opposed to just cowboying it up, right? So that'd be like my preference. Now, I'll just tell you the house painting industry, there's not a ton of $3 million painting companies out there. They're pretty rare, quite frankly. There's a lot more $1 million painting companies than there were 10 years ago. Big part of that's inflation. I'm just kidding. But I would say this industry is on that slow march to professionalizing. And so, yeah, kind of, you know, if we can squint and say in our first year of partnership, we're going to be tracking close to $2 million together, that's about the top line revenue that's required to be able to absorb some of the infrastructure that we're about to pour in to this business.
What does that infrastructure look like?
Yeah. So it's kind of all over the place. It's really, what is this?
One other question to frame it. These are all assumptions. So you are one of the partners in Aleph Holdings, and there's how many partners? Is like everybody become a partner once you buy in or no?
It's a great question. So Aleph Holdings has its own cap table. Aleph Ventures, I'll kind of give the big messy spiel. So you got Aleph Holdings, which is funded through Aleph Capital. Aleph Capital is where the distributions of Aleph Holdings ultimately get funneled through. We also build multifamily apartments. We'll buy land, develop the land, participate in the build, and then hold. Also, outside of apartments, we're investing into painting companies and using some of the cash to do down payments, fund the growth, things like that. So Aleph Ventures is 50% owned by Aleph Holdings, 50% owned by Aleph Capital. At the moment, that's the current cap table. And then there's, you know, 15 painting companies currently that are part of that Aleph Ventures ecosystem.
Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tracking.
And then those, the infrastructure look like, it really depends on the stage of the business and what the founder wants to do. I'd say some of the most common things are hiring, developing, leading people, but also having the infrastructure in place to do that well. All right. So obviously there's like playbooks, there's technology. We have our own software that we've built, an ERP, right? So cradle to grave of a project. And then an LMS, learning management system. That's all great information to have in life. I'll just tell you, the internet has proven out pretty clearly that information is not what holds people back, right? Someone has to lean into the business and do the work with the founder, right? It's been our experience, right? If it was as easy as give me the information and the painting companies shall grow, this industry would look a lot different, because we have this thing called the open internet. And there is a proliferation of coaches who will tell you what you should do. And then private equity would just be buying companies, hiring coaches, and the industry would flourish. That has not happened. That will not happen. It requires the hard work of integration. And that's like the uniqueness of Aleph Holdings, is we're truly co-integrators to scale and stabilize these painting companies into assets, not because we like getting paid as coaches or consultants, because we are co-owners of this company and we want to own assets. So we have that aligned incentive to say, I'm not interested in owning a painting company that's a job. I'm interested in owning painting companies that are assets. And even if I'm a minority owner in that, right, and the founder has the, well, proportional benefit, the majority benefit of that, it's still an aligned incentive. So that's kind of a longer answer of how we lean in through the integration.
So how many people founded Aleph Holdings?
So it was, well, it started with three. Well, it started with two. So it's been a journey. So it started with two, Chet and I.
Chet, did you say?
So two people.
Okay.
So if you go to the PCA Expo.
He also owns a painting company?
Yeah. He's a co-owner of Paris Painting.
Okay.
So it's Chet and myself. And then Micah came from higher education. So he was like the lead sales person at a local university, right? So he had like recruiters underneath him that would try and sell students on come spend 80 grand to get an education, right? That's kind of how that game works. So he left, he's now our VP of sales. Chet is our CEO visionary. Alex, he was working as like a consultant for franchisors. So he would say like the franchise model is dead and dying because he's seen some of the underbelly of that. He plays the role of like integrator president, right? And so that's kind of, and then there's synergy and memes. You can't get anywhere without synergy or memes. That's where I lean in. So there's like five primary shareholders on the Aleph Holdings cap table. And then we have a couple other minority investors within that play key roles in the Aleph organization that have had the opportunity to invest along the way. Sometimes through a profit interest, sometimes through.
Yeah. And how many years ago did it start?
I think it was 2019.
Right before COVID.
Is when we formed it officially.
Is that good timing?
Yeah.
Yeah. The home service industry blew up.
It turned out to be the best. Yeah. I mean, it was scary for about 2 weeks, but anybody in home services would know it's been.
Yeah. That's awesome.
You know, COVID was a big boom.
Super cool. Yeah. I'm curious, was the, where does like a desire that I have is, like cap tables and all that stuff. I feel like I'm an engineer by education, very technical minded, love spreadsheets and data and analysis, but the whole structure and orchestrated like function of holding companies and stuff like that. I don't know why I'm just thinking of like, what's the guy's name? Rockefeller, you know, just like, or Ray Kroc or whatever, just like the architect behind the business model is the, like, there's so much value in the right structure to then serve all, like to align all the monetary incentives with the primary goals of the company and all that. And so that's something I'm super interested in.
Then you have the operating agreement.
Yep. So who's the brains behind that, or because you obviously are speaking very fluently in it. Was this you that brought that to the table, or where has that kind of birthed out of this, or who is like the, how did you decide on the structure that you picked?
Yeah, I would give Chet that credit. I think Chet was the one that brought I brought Chet on, which is kind of a unique thing. The first external role that I hired in Paris Painting was the CEO. And that's how I approached Chet. And I said, Chet, what would it take for you to become CEO of Paris Painting? Now I'm a pretty good CEO. I think I can fill that role. But he is world-class, right? And that was something of, like I said, you start with the vision, and without a compelling vision, the people will cast off their restraints. It's hard to maintain discipline, focus, determination, and sacrifice. We don't know where you're going. And then there's a confidence of, are we heading in the right direction? And I'd say Chet has done a good job of architecting things, you know, multiple 3-5 years in advance of when they need to happen, knowing that that's coming up. You know, same thing they started doing with all the apartments. He saw, you know, 3-4 years ago, we're going to have a pretty big issue called, what do we do with this cash? And it's like kind of facetious of like, oh, what's that? That's your biggest problem in life. Who cares? But like, no, this is like, once the painting companies start to spit off profit, what do you do with that? You can't, do you hold it in cash? Do you put your money in stocks? Do you buy a boat? Do you buy a cabin? Right. And does that ultimately keep us going together? Right? Or do you start to invest? And then, yeah, there's multiple layers to that.
I'm realizing I didn't manage time well, so we're going to go rapid fire on my wrap-up questions.
Sure.
Three book recommendations.
I would go, so I'm a sci-fi guy. I like, I'll just start, say Dune. So I know that's been a popular thing in TV or movie culture now, but Dune series by Frank Herbert, big fan of that. Along with that, the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. That has framed quite a bit of the thinking that I give around individual autonomy versus kind of like macro predestination. And then, I mean, it's hard to not say Ecclesiastes, because that's where I always go when I say like, what the F am I doing with my life sometimes? So I like the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a good grounding book.
And what was the second one you said?
Foundation.
Foundation.
So it's called The Foundation Series by Isaac Asimov.
The Foundation Series.
I don't know how you pronounce it, but he's like one of the best science fiction writers of all time. So
that's awesome. And
but it has not translated over well to visual media. So it's lesser known.
And favorite movie?
Favorite movie. Gosh, there's a couple of close ones. I think I'd still go with Playtime by Jacques Tati.
Playtime.
It's a fun, I mean, it's got, so I did a critique of this on a silly YouTube show that I post that no one watches. But it's like a
1967 drama.
Yeah. 1967 classic.
I don't have time to tell you this, but I'm so pumped that this is why I asked this question, because I am a big ratings guy, and, I'll have to send you a different explanation of this, but 7.3 is my cutoff. That's what I've determined, is like, if it's below that, it's not worth your time typically, but I will take someone's Mulligan recommendation if it's below, but this is a 7.8. It's like a sleeper hit or sleeper, you know, movie.
It's a sleeper hit. It wasn't a big hit in its time. It actually went put into bankruptcy, but it won some awards internationally. And I would say as society has marched forward, I think it was ahead of its time, quite frankly. I think it's a real fun thing to look at nowadays.
Sweet. And if people want to reach out to you, what is your preferred method that they do that?
DM me on social. So I've got Facebook, Instagram. Those are probably the two you can hit me up on. You can also shoot me an email, jason@olive-mgmt.com. So if you figure out how to spell that email, then you pass the bar of being able to talk to me. But social media DMs are probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. Don't ever call me. I'll never answer. I'm a millennial.
Well, Jason, this was super fun. Really love what you're doing. And as I've gotten deeper into the painting world, like we're going to be at PCA this year. We're a sponsor there. And your name just kept coming up, just like Jason Paris. He's like, man, he's everywhere. He's on this podcast. He's on that podcast. What's Aleph Holdings? And I was like, I was excited for the opportunity to get to connect, because we're finding ourselves deeply ingrained. And like I didn't know how long focusing on automating businesses in the painting world would last. And like, when would we have to go to like electrical or HVAC or the next thing? And we're just like going so deep. It's crazy. It's like,
just keep you busy for a good decade or two. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nuts. So anyways.
No, it's a fun, nice to meet you too. I love the business name. Obviously I think it's too clever for the industry right now, but hopefully we can change that, make it so that painters would get it. And then
the thing is that they don't need to get it, because it means nothing to everybody. They're like, boo lean. Is that a diet plan?
Well, the other side is that it might scare them. They might scare them because they think it's a ghost. So yeah, be careful.
That's right. A friend of mine said a boo lean. It's a diet plan for ghosts.
Ooh.
Yeah. But it's a boolean if you are a technical person that knows what a true or false statement is. So anyways, super fun, Jason. Thank you so much for your time. And I'm sure we'll see you at PCA and around.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much for listening. My name is Chris Kiefer, and my mission is to champion the relentless pursuit of purpose. And what that means to me is to be an example, a champion, someone that is in the trenches working and showing and winning and trying and failing in how to pursue a deeper and more meaningful life with the people that I love, with my kids, with my friends, with our family, and also just be a champion and example of entrepreneurship and following my passion and doing what I believe I'm called to on this earth. And so if that inspires you in some way, please share this episode. If you want, like, subscribe, share, whatever, do all the stuff. It means the world to me to get this message and get these guests that I have out there. And if you're interested in any of the book recommendations or looking up other episodes, the movie list, you can visit my website, chriskiefer.com, for all the details on the show. And also check out the Boolean Review software, as well as the Boolean Automation Consulting Company that I own for home service businesses. So thank you so much, and we'll see you on the next episode.